This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The U.S.-led Ukraine Defense Contact Group, made up of 31 member NATO nations of 23 other countries supporting Ukraine in its defense against Russia's invasion, met in Brussels Thursday to discuss Ukraine's counteroffensive and if Ukraine had all it needed success. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb was with U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and told VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine what was discussed.
Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin told everybody today that this Ukraine war is a marathon, not a sprint, and that's why it's so important to keep up with the air defense munitions. That's why it's important to provide them vehicles when needed and spare parts. Mainly what U.S. defense officials tell me is the goal is to not just provide them something when they run out of it, but have these parts and these munitions and these weapons available for them, you know, before they need them. And that is something that Jens Stoltenberg talked about more today. He said that, in fact, NATO allies need to figure out a better way to ramp up their ammunition, not just for providing it to Ukraine, but also to replenish their own stockpiles.
Following the contact group meeting, U.S. General Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, the chairman, said war in Ukraine demonstrates the need to stand with Ukraine and to continue to provide support.
The Ukrainian morale, their leadership, their skill, their tenacity, their resilience is very high. The Russians, on the other hand, their leadership is not necessarily coherent. Their troops' morale is not high. They've been sitting in defensive positions. Many of them don't even know why they're there.
U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mark Milley. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. The Massachusetts Air National Guardsman, accused of leaking highly classified military documents, has been indicted on federal felony charges. The Justice Department says Jack Teixeira faces 6 counts in the indictment of willful retention and transmission of national defense information. He was arrested back in April on charges of sharing highly classified military documents about Russia's war in Ukraine and other top national security issues in a chat room on Discord, a social media platform that started as a hangout for gamers. The stunning breach exposed the world's unvarnished secret assessment of Russia's war in Ukraine. The United States strongly criticized North Korea after Pyongyang test-fired 2 short-range ballistic missiles off its east coast, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
The United States, along with our allies in the region, Japan, the Republic of Korea, condemned today's DPRK missile launches. These launches are a clear violation of multiple UN Security Council resolutions. They demonstrate the threat of DPRK's unlawful weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs posed to the region, to international peace and security, and to the global non-proliferation regime.
The launch of the 2 missiles occurred after South Korean and U.S. troops ended a 5th round of large-scale live fire drills near the Korea's heavily fortified border. The United States says price caps on Russia's oil is cutting revenue nearly in half and weakening its economy. We get more from Lisa Dwyer.
When the Group of 7 Nations and the European Union and Australia last year announced a plan to cap the price of Russia's oil, U.S. officials said it would deliver a most effective blow to Russia's economy, undermining its greatest revenue source. Now, 6 months later, the Biden administration is calling the policy a success. Officials say the price cap has contributed to a significant decline in Russian oil revenue, with a nearly 50% drop compared with last year. The International Energy Agency this week issued its 5-year forecast on oil demand, which suggests that fossil fuels dominance is starting to wane as countries move toward renewable energy sources, which in turn could lessen the economic strength of countries like Russia. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Cyclone Biporjoy made landfall Thursday evening as a vast swath of western India braced for flash floods, heavy rain, and high winds. Authorities expect conditions to worsen for 2 or 3 days as Biporjoy was expected to reach winds gusting up to 140 kilometers before slowing down in India's Gujarat province. Upwards of 100,000 people were evacuated to relief camps. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 16. And here are some of the stories we're covering. Today, Friday, is the final day of campaigning for Sunday's long-delayed constitutional referendum in Mali.
Certain political parties and also some religious leaders and also civil society organizations have been campaigning for the no, but they did not have a lot of space express themselves.
Human Rights Watch says armed Islamist militants in Burkina Faso have killed scores of civilians since 2022. An aid organization warns of a looming food crisis in Sudan. Economists say Sudan's conflict will harm the economies of its neighbors. Sierra Leone's opposition leader calls for the resignation of the Electoral Commission almost a week before the June 24 vote.
The APC will demand that this and all electoral commissions are enforced. So be replaced by an independent internationally accredited team.
And Eritrea and South Sudan are among countries at the bottom of this year's U.S. human trafficking report. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Friday is the final day of campaigning for Sunday's long-delayed constitutional referendum in Mali between the yes and the no supporters. The military, led by Colonel Assimi Goïta, overthrew the country's last democratically elected president in August of 2020. The African Union says the referendum would pave the way for elections in February 2024. Some Malians say the new constitution gave too much power to the president. Moussa Kondo is the executive director of the Sahel Institute, a group that is dedicated to promoting and consolidating democracy in the Sahel region. From Bamako, he tells me that the No Coalition has been having a difficult time getting its message through because they have been denied public spaces to hold their rallies.
We've seen since the beginning of the campaign of the two biggest sides of the yes and the no. Certain political parties and also some religious leaders and also civil society organizations been campaigning for the no, but they did not have a lot of space to express themselves. Also, we've seen the yes branch walking along through campaigning all around the cities and also the stadiums in Bamako and other parts of the country. And the biggest closing campaign day is planned for Friday, where the yes is mobilizing people to fill up the biggest stadium in the country, start the Vinci maps for the closing campaign before the voting.
So you said those planning to vote no are not having enough time to campaign. Why is that?
Recently, we've seen the president of the opposition, LA, as there is no, but Isaka Ujim, who has been member of the National Transitional Committee as a replacement of the National Assembly, he and a couple of other political parties joined in the coalition have been refused places to organize their meeting and press conference. But they've been able to organize it through private platforms, online and other space, to tell to people why to vote no for this constitution.
Briefly, those people who are planning to vote no, why are they going to vote no?
There are a couple of reasons about the no. First, they're talking about the current constitution's Article 118 mentioning we cannot organize referendum if the entire territory of the country is not under the control of the government and under the state, which is not exactly the case today because it has been really hard recently to have conversation with the former rebel groups based in Kidal and controlling this area. And also certain parts of the central regions of Mali where it is very hard and completely out of control of the national or the public administration. And the second biggest reason said we cannot organize referendum at least 6 months before the elections. And the case we are living right now is the local and regional elections are happening less than 6 months. And also, there are other branches mentioning about the superpower given to the president in the new constitution.
That was Musa Kondo, Executive Director of the Sahel Institute, a group that is dedicated to promoting and consolidating democracy in the Sahel region. He was speaking with us from Mali's capital, Bamako. The U.S.-based group Human Rights Watch says armed Islamist militants in Burkina Faso have killed scores of civilians, looted and burned property, and forced thousands to flee attacks across the country since 2022. Human Rights Watch also says Islamists besieged several towns, cutting residents off from food and humanitarian aid. Ilaria Allegrazzi is the senior researcher on the Sahel for Human Rights Watch. She tells me that the transitional authorities in Burkina Faso should work with regional bodies and concerned governments to provide better protection and assistance for people at risk.
We documented summary killings, looting, burning of homes and property by armed Islamist groups, mostly fighters from the Jenim, a group linked to Al-Qaeda, and across Burkina Faso. We documented attacks since January in several regions of the country, the Sahel region, the center-north region, center-west region. But of course, this is only the tip of the iceberg, because the frequency of attacks by those armed groups is alarming. They are becoming increasingly abusive. They have killed hundreds of civilians, they have destroyed villages, they have looted properties, they have looted livestock. And this violence has forced thousands of people to flee. The witnesses we spoke to, they recounted the tragic moments of the attacks in their villages. When the fighters came, they burned down their properties, their homes. They killed their loved ones. You see, the situation is particularly worrying, especially now that armed Islamist groups control over 40% of the Burkina Faso territory.
So how did you gather your information?
Well, we traveled to Burkina Faso in February. We interviewed people who have been affected by the conflict and violence. We spoke to displaced people with victims of abuses by the Islamist fighters. We conducted also remote interviews with witnesses of abuses, with political analysts, experts on the region, members of national civil society organizations, but also international organizations working in Burkina Faso, with journalists as well. And so that's how we put the report together.
What is the Burkina Faso military government? I mean, what are they doing to counter the Islamist behavior or their influence?
Well, the military authorities have, first of all, relied very strongly on local militias in their counterinsurgency operations. They have launched a campaign to recruit 50,000 civilian auxiliaries called the Volunteers for the Defense of the Homeland. And they work alongside these civilians to counter the threats posed by the Islamist fighters. However, I think it's important to underline that military operations against the jihadists have also led to increased violence against civilians by both state forces and their affiliated militias.
We know the Sahel region is experiencing so much trouble from the drought and other issues. Now, how would you describe the humanitarian situation there?
The humanitarian situation in Burkina Faso is at the moment very concerning at best, I should say almost catastrophic. Burkina Faso is one of the worst, most neglected crises at the moment. There are 5 million people in need of humanitarian assistance, 2 million people internally displaced. Access to education is almost non-existent for thousands of children.
Thank you so much again. A pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, James.
Ilaria Allegrazzi is the senior researcher at the Sahel for Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with me from Rome, Italy. Sierra Leone's opposition leader, Samora Camara, is demanding the resignation of the entire Electoral Commission. He is accusing the government of intimidation and the security forces of arresting and detaining his supporters. From Freetown, reporter Kevin Lewis has the details.
Sierra Leone's opposition leader, Samora Camara, has announced 6 complaints regarding the Electoral Commission. They include the appointment and qualifications for the office of the Electoral Commissioner, the introduction of the proportional representation system of voting, and questions over the midterm census, which he said would be used to rig the vote. He also complained about the poor quality voter cards, the voter registration process, and state-sponsored intimidation and violence against opposition supporters. Kamara issued 15 demands, including guarantees that polling stations use manual and not electronic transmission of results, the release of a final voters list, an independent forensic audit of the voter register, and the use of foreign judges to help adjudicate in electoral disputes. He also wants the government to promise it will not shut down internet during the vote.
The APC will demand that Mr. Mohamed Kone and all electoral commission resign forthwith, to be replaced by an independent, internationally accredited team.
Mohamed Kone, the chief electoral commissioner, says he has been cooperating with the APC.
There was a meeting we had with the All People's Congress where the Secretary General, three times he was asking if the elections were going to be conducted in June, on 24th June. And three times we said yes. So as far as we are concerned, we have done whatever we could. They have been part of the process. In fact, three issues when I assumed office to make credible elections. One, inclusion, transparency, and accountability. And all of the activities we have been doing here, political parties have been briefed. They have been part of our discussions. So for them to wait at this time to tell us that they are going to, if we do not do whatever they are demanding, whatever decision they will take, we are not going to resign.
Mohamed Suarez, the head of communications for the ruling SLPP's campaign, he says the APC wants to avoid the elections.
If you read what I've read into it, this is part of a deliberate attempt by the APC to run away from a very humiliating and disastrous defeat that awaits them at the June 24th polls.
There are only 9 days left to polling day, and Samora Kamara's ultimatum expires Friday. He did not, however, say what they will do if their demands are not met. For VOA Africa, I'm Kelvin Lewis reporting from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 16. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. The aid organization Mercy Corps says continued fighting in Sudan could trigger a catastrophic food crisis. This comes as East African leaders say they plan to meet with Sudanese warring generals in person for the first time next week to mediate the ongoing conflict. VOA's Africa correspondent Mariama Diallo has this story.
A catastrophic food crisis looms in Sudan if the fighting doesn't stop, says Fridun Borhani, team leader for Mercy Corps in Gedaref State on the Ethiopian-Sudanese border northeast of Sudan.
Right now is the planting season in Gedaref State, for example. People, they must buy seeds for plantation. The price of the seeds go very high, and this is create problem for the farmers.
But that's not the only challenge farmers face, Borhani notes.
Beside that, the number of people to move to here, this is create a lack of food in the market, or the price of food in the market is very high. Some people cannot afford to purchase this food. Some places 134% increase with flour, rice, sugar, also like 100% or more.
Mercy Corps had plans to distribute seeds to about 2,100 farmers in three states, including Gedaref, Niala, and Kordofan. But for security reasons, it will only be able to give seeds to 700 farmers in Gedaref starting next week. The latest 24-hour ceasefire negotiated by the United States and Saudi Arabia expired early Sunday, and the war is showing no signs of ending anytime soon as fighting continues in parts of the capital of Khartoum and elsewhere. Next Tuesday, Kenya's President William Ruto said he and other East African leaders plan to meet the Sudanese generals in person to discuss ways to end the war. The announcement follows a gathering of heads of states and government convened by the East African bloc IGAD in Djibouti earlier this week.
We have taken the decision that the quartet of Kenya, Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Somalia will, in the next 10 days, meet face-to-face with General Burhan and General Dagalo. in a face-to-face engagement so that we can speak to them directly on behalf of IGAD with a view of stopping the war that is raging in Sudan.
Macharia Munene, professor of history and international relations at the United States International University in Nairobi, tells VOA the in-person meetings between the two generals is a good step, but there are more factors at play.
The problem with IGAD and with AU is that it depends on the EU and external forces of resources to operate. That's the main problem. Associated with that is that sometimes it's difficult to agree on anything, in part because the players are depending on advice and resources from outside.
Abdisalan Adan, education and peace advocate and the director of Marifa College in Kenya, told VOA bringing them to the table might be the solution here, but there's much to accomplish between now and then.
First of all, bridging the gap and bringing the trust among the two guys. And from our side, like Kenya, we should see the conflict from the wider perspectives and then work very softly in terms of bringing all actors together, international actors together, not only IGAD, we can bring on board African Union, European Union, and Americans.
Ruto also says they will try to convince the warring factions to establish a humanitarian corridor in the next 2 weeks, and following that, initiate a process of an inclusive national dialogue. Since the war started about 2 months ago, more than 1.65 million people have been displaced, including more than 1.2 million within the country and about 500,000 to neighboring countries. As long as the conflict continues, Mercy Corps says humanitarian needs will grow among the populations that were already severely food insecure. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
The International Credit Rating Agency, Moody's, and the International Monetary Fund said the Sudan conflict will harm its neighbors' economies if it continues. In the markets of N'Djamena, Chad's capital, traders and customers alike have already been feeling the pinch from high inflation as the economic fallout of the war threatens their love of hot, sweet tea. Henry Wilkins reports.
In the markets of N'Djamena, Chad's capital, the economic effects of Sudan's conflict are already being felt. Hot sweet tea, a favourite beverage for many Chadians, has been one of the first casualties. Almost all the country's red tea, so-called for its rich colour, as well as Chad's supply of sugar, are imported from Sudan. Tea seller Abdou Ala Mohamed told VOA he has had to raise prices. He says it's part of the culture, and some people like their tea sweet. Adding that since the fighting started, his business has been affected and the sugar is more expensive. Market trader Idris Adam Ismail said that because no goods have been coming from Sudan since the war started, he now has to buy sugar from Cameroon, which is more expensive, putting even more pressure on his business, already suffering from high inflation. He said that before the conflict, a bag of sugar from Sudan cost about $50. But now it's gone up to around $90. He added that goods are more expensive than people can afford because of the Sudan fighting. He said he wants the fighting to end so that he can continue his business in the best way possible. N'Djamena has a closer trading relationship with Cameroon than Sudan, but analysts say cities in the east of Chad, for which the opposite is true, are suffering the most. Hoinathi Ramaji is an analyst for the Institute for Security Studies.
All the big cities along the eastern border, starting from Adre, Abéché, Amjaras, etc., have a very close connection with Sudan. And there was a lot of business then coming from the Sudanese port.
The economic impacts of Sudan's war are not confined to Chad. After returning from a recent visit to Cairo, Patrick Heinisch, an emerging markets economist covering the Horn of Africa and Nile Valley at the German bank Helaba, described the economic impact there.
They already say that real estate prices in Cairo have risen because of the influx of Sudanese refugees. They also want accommodation. They're looking for apartments. So this is one of the first impacts. It also depends on how many people will in the future continue to escape to the neighboring countries? So will it really have an impact on overall inflation, for example?
Moody's Investor Service, a US-based credit rating company, has said the Sudan conflict will likely hurt Sudan's neighbors' credit ratings, as well as those of developed banks in the region, while the International Monetary Fund also warns of growing economic impacts as the war continues. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Jemena, Chad.
The U.S. government has released its annual report, Surveying Human Trafficking Around the World. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
The State Department's annual Trafficking in Persons report places 24 countries and territories in the lowest and most troubling Tier 3 category, including Afghanistan, Burma, Cambodia, China, Eritrea, North Korea, Russia, South Sudan, and Venezuela. Tier 3 countries fall below minimum standards and haven't demonstrated significant efforts to come into compliance. They are subject to potential sanctions. The report also lists Libya, Somalia, and Yemen as special cases where civil conflicts create difficulties in gaining information. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with basketball. 16 countries will take part in the inaugural Giants of Africa Youth Basketball Festival. The festival is part of Giants of Africa, a not-for-profit organization's way of enriching the lives of African youth through sports. Countries that will be participating include the host Rwanda, Tanzania, Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Senegal, Somalia, Uganda, Botswana, Ghana, South Sudan, Morocco, Cameroon, and Mali. The festival is set to take place from August 13th to the 19th in Kigali and will bring together more than 250 youths from the 16 countries to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the foundation. Co-founder of the organization, Masai Ujiri, who is the vice chairman and president of the Toronto Raptors of the NBA, said the foundation's aim is to continue to inspire and encourage the youth of Africa.
Well, the energy of that basketball brings generally is just incredible. I was just at BAL, spent a lot of time with obviously basketball people. It's something that we need more of, and that's why we wanted to create the festival too, you know, like to have this moment on the continent where we start believing that we can do it.
Staying with basketball news, Rwanda local basketball governing body FEWABA has named the provisional teams that will represent the country at the under 16 Zone 5 Africa Basketball Championship qualifiers due in Kigali from June 27th to the 30th. The qualifiers are expected to attract 10 countries. These include Uganda, Burundi, Tanzania, Egypt, Kenya, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Djibouti, Somalia, and the host Rwanda, while Algeria, Angola, Egypt, Mali, Uganda, and host Tunisia have already qualified for the continental showpiece. Six remaining tickets will be determined through the qualifiers in Kigali. And now to netball. Zimbabwe's netball team coach, Ropafadzo Mosauki, has intensified his team's preparations with more focus on coming up with the right combinations before the Netball World Cup in Cape Town, South Africa. The Gems are expected to kickstart their final pre-World Cup camp early May, but only resumed on Sunday due to financial constraints. Coach Matsuoki said they are now putting more emphasis on team tactics ahead of the global competition scheduled for July 18th to August 6th in South Africa. Elsewhere, Algeria will take part in the second edition of the Africa Beach Games from June 23rd to the 30th in Hammamet, Tunisia. 86 athletes from 12 disciplines will represent Algeria in this tournament organized by the Association of National Olympic Committees of Africa and the Tunisian National Olympic Committee. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, June 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.